October 27th, it's Thursday night. We're beginning our study here at Beth Torah of the book of Job. So, the book of Job has been subject to many commentaries, both among Jews and non-Jews, over the course of thousands of years. It's a very difficult book to understand, both as far as the language goes and as far as the subject matter, as we're about to see. It's complicated stuff. It's given to many different interpretations. And I am certainly going to present suggestions for direction of understanding, but I'm also going to try not to prejudice it too much and to leave open different possibilities and explore things together with you. And I hope that I'll learn things just as you'll learn things. So I'm not going to push too much for one particular way you have to understand it, but again, I will make some suggestions that we'll discuss and we'll deal with. That's one of the reasons that I don't want to prejudice too much how we're going to look at the book. I want us to look at it with fresh eyes. That's one of the reasons I'm going to give almost no introduction to the author, to the time period, and to the meaning of the book. I want to just open it up and see what it says to us. And we'll figure out for ourselves, and we'll discuss it from the information that we read. Well, when do you think it was written, or who wrote it, or was he Jewish or not Jewish? Is the character, the main character, Job, does he seem to be Jewish or not Jewish? Do the ideas seem to fit in with the rest of the Bible? I don't want to say too much before we actually open up the pages of the book. There is one type of introduction I do want to give, and for many of the people in the room, it'll be a review, and I think a very important review. What I want to do is the following. So, the book is, at this point, part of the Bible. It's part of the Jewish Bible, part of Jewish scripture. It's been put there by Jewish tradition, and the, let's call them the editors of the Bible, the ancient rabbis that put the book of Job into the Bible, they want us to read it as part of the Bible and not in a vacuum. So therefore, though I don't want to give detailed introductions about the book itself, I do want to give introduction about the context that it's put into, in that it's part of the Bible. The subject that it deals with, which I haven't yet revealed, we want to take a few minutes to introduce that subject as it's dealt with in the Bible, so we can understand what the editors of the Bible thought we know about the subject when we get to the continued dealing with it in the book of Job. So let's open up to the very beginning, which is going to be on the screen very soon, and if it's not, I'll just read to you, just to see the subject of the book, and then we'll start introducing that subject as it's found in the rest of the Bible. So I'm going to read in chapter 1, verse 1, and then I'm just going to read verses 13 to 19, just to get the subject matter. Not yet, huh? So I'm going to read. Verse 1. So it's as follows. There was a man in the land of Uz named Job. And then verse 13. One day, as his sons and his daughters were eating and drinking wine in the house of their eldest brother, a messenger came to Job and said, "The oxen were plowing and the she-asses were grazing alongside them, when Sabians attacked them and carried them off and put the boys to the sword. I alone have escaped to tell you." This one was still speaking when another came and said, "God's fire fell from heaven, took hold of the sheep and the boys and burned them up. I alone have escaped to tell you." This one was still speaking when another came and said, "A Chaldean formation of three columns made a raid on the camels and carried them off and put the boys to the sword. I alone have escaped to tell you." This one was still speaking when another came and said, "Your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in the house of their eldest brother when suddenly a mighty wind came from the wilderness. It struck the four corners of the house so that it collapsed upon the young people and they died. I alone have escaped to tell you." That's enough. That's the subject of the book. The subject of the book is bad things happening to good people. As we say in Hebrew, it's tzaddik v'ra lo, righteous and bad, or rasha v'tov lo, evil and prosperous. It's a subject of theodicy, of providence and theodicy, that we spent a good half year on last time. Now, earlier the books of the Bible deal with this implicitly, in different places, sometimes dealing with it explicitly in a small amount of material. Last year we talked about Breshit, about Shmot, about Vayikra, Bamidbar, in the context of the Odyssey. The book of Jeremiah deals with it in a few verses. The book of Ecclesiastes deals with it. But the book of Job is devoted wholeheartedly from beginning to end to the question of why the bad things happen to good people. So, I want to give a context of theodicy in the Bible for most of today. Again, a review of things that we did last year to understand what we should know when we open up the book and the subject that it deals with. I'm going to put on a table 4 points that are at the foundation of the struggle with the problem of theodicy, why do bad things happen to good people. In other words, you have to make the following assumptions for the question to be meaningful. To be bothered by the question of why do bad things happen to good people, you make 4 assumptions. The first assumption is there's a God. If there's no God, then it doesn't bother me. Why do bad things happen to good people? Because why should they not happen? Why not? I assume there's a God. And I assume, this is number 2, that God is just. And I assume also, 3, that God has the power to control what happens to human beings. If I make this, God has the power to control, to manipulate, to determine what happens to human beings. Say that again?
To intervene.
Yes.
But it does not.
It could be. That's my next assumption. Very good. And the 4th assumption is that actually God does intervene and control what happens. In other words, I assume there's a God. I assume he's just. I assume he can control what happens. And 4thly, I assume that he does. Only if I make those 4 assumptions can I be bothered, religiously bothered, by the problem of theodicy. Because, look, if there's a God, and if he's just, and if he can intervene, if he does, then things have to work out justly. They have to work out righteously. They have to work out fairly. And if they don't, then God is remiss. God is not doing his job. God is not acting like God. God isn't doing what he should be doing. If I make those 4 assumptions, and things happen in this world that don't make sense, that they're not fair, that they're not just, and I'll be bothered by the question. As a believer, I'll be driven to despair by the question. It'll keep me up at night. I may even come to the brink of losing my faith, because how could it be that God isn't being what God is supposed to be? So, of course, the Bible deals with this in many levels, like I said earlier, implicitly, in a lot of different places. Perhaps Job, perhaps he knew, perhaps he didn't know that the Bible has something to say about this before he comes on the scene. But that doesn't help. Because even if we've dealt with this many times, intellectually, when it hits us, when Job suffers, you still scream out, why? Because it hurts, and it's tragic, and it's painful, and it cuts to the core of my belief in God. My belief in what God is, my belief in God's justice, my belief in his connection to the world, and his caring and intervention in the world. So, for the purpose of knowing what Job might know if he read the early parts of the Bible, for the purpose of knowing what the editors of the Bible think we know, for the purpose of refreshing our vocabulary in the subject of theodicy that's going to help us deal with what's dealt with in the book, let's review very quickly things we've talked about in Breshit, because that's a book of the Bible we all know, and that really sets the tone for so much that comes later. Let's try and very briefly remember what we knew about theodicy from the book of Breshit. So, the vocabulary we developed there first begins with the word hashkaha, providence. Right? Providence means that God... It means all the 4 things we said. It means that God exists, that God is just, that God has the power to intervene, that God does intervene. Providence, that God providentially intervenes, cares, directs, makes sure that what happens is supposed to happen. Right? That's providence. And we talked about 2 different types of providence. We talked about hashkacha klalit, general providence, klalit from the word kol, right? general all, hashkacha kalit, we talk about hashkacha pratit. Pratit, think of the word prat, private, individual. Right? Hashkacha pratit, individual providence. We talk about hashkacha kalit, we mean the idea, the belief, that God directs, intervenes, providentially cares for large bodies of people, for groups, like the Jewish people. And we would say that, what happens to nations, what happens to the Jewish people over the long run, as a collective, that is in some sense directed by God's caring providence. While it might not be the case that individuals within that group get their just deserts. In other words, there might be hashkacha kalit and not hashkacha pratit. But if we believe in hashkacha pratit, then we're saying that not only does God care for the nation, but he cares for the individual, and the individual should get his just deserts. Now, the question of theodicy, why do bad things happen to good people, is a question of why do things happen to good people. No, it's individuals. For the question to bother us, the question of theodicy, we have to believe in hashkacha pratit. We have to assume that when we say that God exists and God is just and God can intervene and God does intervene, it means intervene, it means control the lives of individuals. Only if I believe in that am I going to be theologically hurt by the question of theodicy. And if I believe that God exists and God is just and God intervenes, and that, but I only believe that he intervenes in the life of the nation as a collective, then it won't bother me when my best friend gets run over by a car. It'll hurt. Tragically, it'll hurt, but it won't be a complaint against God. I'm not saying it doesn't hurt. Don't misunderstand me. It's not a tragedy. Of course it's a tragedy. But it won't hurt me theologically, because I'll just say, God is making sure in the long run that the Jewish people are redeemed from exile, and it might take 100 years, 1,000 years, 1,000,000 years. I'm sure about that. But in the interim, individuals are going to die, and there's going to be disease and cancer and suffering and Alzheimer's, and it's a tragedy, but it won't be a complaint against God. Because I never thought that God really gets involved in the lives of individuals. Only if I believe that God gets involved in the life of individuals does the issue of the book of Job begin. Right? I could even say that in a slightly more nuanced fashion. Probably the book of Job was written at a time when people began to really believe in individual providence. That's when the book had to be written to deal with the question. But before people believed in individual providence, if there was such a time, then there's no need for the book of Job. Kind of cynically, I'm saying that it's our belief that creates the issue, right? If you want to jettison the belief, then there's no issue. Things just happen because they happen. And it's not clear, as we learned last year, it's not clear that the book of Genesis, for example, really does believe in hashkacha pratit. But it's clear by the end of the Bible, when you get to the book of Job, it's clear that the author of the book of Job really believes in deep hashkacha pratit. Otherwise, he'd have no reason to write the book. Wouldn't be bothered by the issue. Okay. So, yeah.
Talking about hashkacha pratit, that's an individual.
You're saying the difference between the two terms?
God's responding to an individual as opposed to a people.
Right, hashkacha.
But, if God does not intervene in nature, how is it that in the Torah, God is all over the place talking to individuals?
Okay, right now. Thank you very much. That's what I'm going to do right now. So, actually, you took the words right out of my mouth. Because clearly, right, as... Okay. Clearly, as Gilda just said, God talks to and directs the lives of individuals from beginning to end, at least in the Torah. And isn't that hashkacha pratit? So the answer is perhaps, but not necessarily. Because it would be easy to say that God gets involved in and directs the life and what happens to Avraham, to Sarah, to Yitzchak, to Yaakov, to the patriarchs and the matriarchs and Moshe and Aaron and Miriam, but not because God wants to and does get involved in the life of each individual, but rather because these people are central players in the collective. To be involved in the life of Avraham is to be involved in the life of the whole Jewish people. He was the Jewish people. You know, it's the fundamental creation of the Jewish people. And it could be, it makes a lot of sense, that God directs the life of Moshe and Aaron, not because, and it certainly doesn't prove, that God gets involved in the life of every Moshe, Levi, and Shmuel, and Hanan, and Tom, Dick, and Harry, but he's directing the Jewish people. That's what involved in the life of Moshe and Aaron. You could certainly easily make that claim. And I think that makes a lot of sense.
But you can find examples of God intervening in ordinary people's lives.
Can you? Let's begin in Breshit, Shmot, Vayikra. Can you?
Well, I have something in mind later in the Bible. Elijah bringing back the widow's son.
Okay, but again, it
she wasn't a king or a queen.
But if we want to prove from the Bible that God is concerned in and involved in the lives of all individuals, finding one or two or three or five or 10 or 20 examples is not going to prove that.
Well, you can't just ignore those examples either.
But in every case, we'll say there's a special reason. Right? You still can't. Okay, that's enough. But then I'm not going to be tragically upset with God when my best friend is hit by a car. I'm going to say, God, you promised that you control the destiny of everything that happens. He was good. Why didn't you reward him? God will just say, when did I promise that? The fact that I get involved in the lives of 20 people in the Bible, I had a special reason for it. And in most cases, we'll find that the reason has to do with the collective of the Jewish people or the collective of another people, the fate of a nation. Okay, so it's not clear at all that we could prove Hashkacha Pratit from Breshit, Shmot, Vayikra, etc. Now, the opposite is the case, and this many of you will remember from last year. We could probably make a good case from the very, very beginning of Breshit that, in general, there is no Hashkacha Pratit. Because we look at the fratricide, the murder of Cain and Abel. Now, it's certainly true that Cain was punished by God after he did what he did. But what about Abel? He died. He was killed. And there's no indication in the Torah at all that he deserved to die. The opposite of the case. His offering was accepted by God. If anyone deserved to die, it's the person who killed him. So where's the Hashkacha Pratit? Where's the providence? The Torah seems to say, from the very outset, God doesn't always intervene. Because remember, here it's really, really clear. In the case of Cain and Abel, when Cain arose and murdered his brother, God was there. God's talking right before that. And God says to Cain, I'm paraphrasing, I know what you're about to do. It's not a good idea. Remember when God says, Lefetach hatat revetz, sin crouches at the door? He's telling Cain, you know, I know what you're thinking, and I see your urges. Hold yourself back. And God says, whoever controls himself is rewarded. And the next thing is a murder. So God was there. God knew that it was about to happen, and God didn't intervene. To me, that makes a strong case, actually almost a watertight case, that at least sometimes God doesn't intervene. In other words, there's not, across the board, Hashkacha Pratit, at least not in the book of Breshit, that God lets bad things happen to good people. It's a matter of course. And it's not a kushya, it's not a difficulty, it's not a theological difficulty. That's the way God is. Therefore, we don't have to learn the book of Job.
Yeah.
Right.
I'm
So, you might react and say, okay, you're right. God didn't intervene to prevent the murder of Abel. But I can explain why. God didn't intervene because God doesn't tamper with free will. And God couldn't or wouldn't, doesn't want to, prevent murder committed by another human being because God wants human beings to exercise their free will. However, you'll say, perhaps in cases that don't involve free will, there God does intervene. And God certainly, even though he doesn't prevent murders, he does prevent heart attacks to good people, you might say. There, of course, he'll intervene because it's not a matter of preventing free will. And God certainly prevents people who are righteous from falling off a mountain cliff and dying because God is concerned, you might say. But then we just look further on in the book of Bereshit. We look, for example, at the death of Rachel. She died by the wayside. I'm sorry, I said that incorrectly. She died b'derech, on the way, between Beit Lechem and Ephrat, only about a 10-minute drive from my house in Israel. And it says she died in childbirth. Why did she die? Because of her childbirth. Not because she deserved it. Doesn't say she deserved it. Doesn't say anything about reward and punishment there. Just says she died. That's what happened. It's a tragedy. The Torah describes a tragedy. And the impression we get is that that's the way the world is. The tragedies happen. Not only when they're inflicted by human beings with their free will, but even when they're a matter of nature. God lets things happen. That's the strong impression that you can get from the Torah, that even natural events that hurt us sometimes occur for no good moral reason. And if that's all true, and it is, then really we should not be disturbed. In this sense, shouldn't have a complaint against God when my best friend gets hit by a car or when Job suffers and loses all his family. His children die. And we'll see later on he gets a terrible skin disease. He's in pain 24 hours a day. Again, it's a tragedy. But it might not be a complaint against God.
Okay, I see what you're saying, but when you look at the book of Job and you look at the part that we didn't read about the adversary...
Ooh! We're going to get to that, I promise. We're not going to skip it.
Because then that shows, at least with Job, God is allowing it to happen and knows it's going to happen.
Of course. Of course, right. Everything I said is important, and it provides us, I think, with the vocabulary and the building blocks to deal with these questions. But in the end, the book of Job holds differently. The book of Job absolutely holds that God does, should, must be involved in making sure that just things happen to good people and that just things happen to bad people. Otherwise, the book would have nothing to go on. But we can certainly see that as a development beyond the book of Bereshit, beyond the book of Shemot, beyond the book of Vayikra. It's a further development in the religious consciousness of the Jewish people. A developing certainty that perhaps didn't exist in the Torah, that God does, should, and must be involved completely and absolutely in the lives of individuals. And what that should mean is, well, if God is God, and God is just, and God can get involved. Now, the fourth assumption that perhaps the book of Bereshit doesn't make, but Job does make, that God does get involved in the life of individuals all the time, all individuals all the time. That fourth assumption, again, that's missing from Bereshit and missing from most of the Torah, that seems to be the bedrock of the book of Job. That yes, so God exists and God is just and God can get involved and God does get involved and must get involved in all the lives of all individuals. And without that fourth assumption, the beginning of the book of Job wouldn't work. Wouldn't begin. Okay. A little bit more. Right. A little bit more of introduction. And again, this is a little bit of review of things we did last year. Even if we assume that there is hashkacha pratit, even in the book of Bereshit, let's assume there is, putting aside what I said. The book of Bereshit might already give us the building blocks to grapple with the issue of theodicy. Let me give you an example. In other words, even if we assume the four assumptions that God exists and God is just and God can direct human events and that God does direct human events for even all individuals, even if we assume all that, we already have building blocks to grapple with the matter of theodicy before we get to the book of Job. And what I mean is the following. We remember that Abraham is certainly righteous, beloved of God. But does he have the easiest life in the world? Does it look like he's rewarded? The opposite is the case. For the first 99 years of his life, and the first 90 years of the life of Sarah, no children. And it bothers them. It's terrible. They can't take it. They're frustrated, terribly frustrated. They're despondent. It breaks them up. Do they deserve that? And then Avraham, well, think of Avraham and Sarah again. She is abducted by Avimelech, then abducted by Paro. Avraham almost loses his wife. She almost loses her life. Do they deserve that? And then the Akedah. It says, Velokim nisat Avraham. God tried Avraham. He was commanded to put a knife to his son. There's a midrash that says, when Sarah heard about it, she died. Parcha nishmata, she lost her soul. So Avraham and Sarah, they suffered most of their life. And think of what happened with Ishmael in the house, or the conflict between the children. Some of us know what conflict between children, what pain it causes. But they didn't deserve that. But the answer is simple. They didn't deserve it, but God brought it upon them to teach them something. That's what it means that God tried Avraham. It's explicit there. What does it mean God tried Avraham? God brought about upon him adversity in order to steel him, to build him, to mature him, to improve him, to uplift him. We talked about all this a number of times in the past. In other words, to put this into the language we developed last year, we don't see in the life of Avraham, we don't see, at least in things I mentioned, reactive divine providence, but we do see proactive divine providence, which means reactive, that God reacts to the past. When people want justice, if I'm good, I should be rewarded, if I'm bad, I should be punished, they want God to react to yesterday, to last year, to give me now what I deserve because of what I did yesterday. And if I don't get what I deserve, people scream bloody murder against God. But already the book of Bereshit, not only on the one hand does it show there might not be hashkacha pratit at all, but secondly, even if there is, hashkacha pratit, divine providence for the individual, is not necessarily only, merely a matter of rewarding and punishing for what happened yesterday. It's much more perhaps a matter of doing things in my life today, of God intervening and controlling my life in order to accomplish something for the future. I might be the most righteous person in the world, and God causes me to suffer because God is not focusing on me as far as reactive providence goes, but he's focusing on me as far as proactive. He wants to bring me to a certain place. He wants to improve my soul. He wants to uplift me. He wants to steel me. He wants to mature me. And through suffering, we all know, through suffering, through overcoming stumbling blocks and challenges, we become better people. We need, actually, a certain degree of pain to become mature human beings. And that could fall under the category of indeed hashkaha, providence. But not reactive divine providence, but proactive divine providence. And if we, and that, after I say it, it seems so simple, seems so obvious. God is not so one-dimensional that he's only involved in reacting to the past. Isn't God more sophisticated than that? Of course, of course. Isn't God also involved? If he's involved at all, then isn't he involved in something more sophisticated than just reacting to yesterday and giving us marks for the test we took? But he's a parent, at least, building something of his children. And if that's true, it means even if there is hashkacha pratit, individual providence, then we already know from the book of Genesis, even if there is such a thing, we already know from the book of Genesis that it's not necessarily a matter of a good grade for good performance. It might be that you actually, if you're a fine, righteous person, God makes you suffer because he sees that this is a person that has the potential to become better. So what I'm trying to say, I know I'm so long-winded, is that we already have, before we get to the book of Job, we already have some tools in our toolbox to deal with the issue of why do bad things happen to good people. Let's see. Yep. Okay, that's my introduction. Now I can start learning. You want to talk about it a little bit before we actually read the book?
I'm not disagreeing. I just want to add something. It seems like there's a big question, too. Not so much even whether God intervenes or not, but is our faith going to withstand bad things if we think we don't deserve them? It seems like that's a big question there. You know, can one's faith, what does it take for one's faith to be sustained?
On an intellectual level, again, on an intellectual level, of course I understand it's not just intellectual, but on intellectual level, one needs to have the tools in the toolbox, right? If you never thought of the idea, let's say, of proactive divine providence, you're just stuck in the rut of reactive divine providence, then bad things happen to good people, and you're lost. Mm-hmm. You're just lost. Mm-hmm. And the Talmud describes people who lost their faith because they saw bad things happening to good people, mm-hmm. and there's certainly many stories about Holocaust survivors, mm-hmm. and it's understandable. It's understandable.
But the idea has to be there, or you wouldn't. The question wouldn't even arise about losing your faith.
Right. There has to be faith to begin with to lose it, and there has to be, I think, a faith in Hashkacha Pratit in order to be bothered.
Yeah.
So I can have a perfect faith of the deistic kind, which means I believe, let's say, in God the Watchmaker. That God created the world and let it run on its own. And then, God forbid, I come across the Holocaust. That doesn't bother my faith. The Holocaust doesn't prove that God didn't make the world turn around and let it go. It's only if I have a belief that God is really concerned and involved every minute in the lives of individuals that I'm bothered by bad things happening to good people. Right? And it's kind of funny because sometimes you see a kind of cognitive dissonance. I think that I know a lot of people that are bothered. Why do bad things happen to good people, especially when they happen to me? They're bothered. But if you scratch them, they don't believe in providence to begin with. So why are they bothered? Right? You know that bestseller, Lawrence Kushner, Why Do Bad Things Happen to Good People? It was on the bestseller list. It sold hundreds of thousands of copies. I'm not sure that hundreds of thousands of those people actually believed in the premise of individual divine providence. But when tragedy strikes, you're bothered. You look for answers to questions that really you don't even have, in a certain sense. Okay.
All right. I see one potential problem with what you're saying about the proactive divine providence, and it's unsatisfying. And you didn't say this, but I'm going to say it and get it out on the table. It's unsatisfying to try to say that when God either brings about bad things or allows bad things, it's always for some better purpose. And so it's Pollyanna to say that, yeah, bad things happen to you because there's some benefit that you derive from it, when it's easy to come up with examples of bad things to happen to people and there's no benefit to them that justifies that. So that's lurking back there, I think.
And you're right. You're right. It's as if challenges build us and steel us and mature us and improve us only when we have the strength to overcome them. But if they overcome us, then there's no benefit. For example, I'm allowing myself to talk about cancer, even though it's a very, very painful subject, because my wife experienced a number of different bouts of cancer, so I kind of feel that I have the right to talk about it. My wife said, after the fact, of course, that it made her a better person. But if it had killed her, and it kills a lot of people, it didn't make them a better person.
Yeah. And you could say, well, it made somebody else a better person. Well, wait a minute. That doesn't seem fair.
Right.
It may have made them a better person before they died. They just didn't live to experience being a better person.
It's rather 10 years.
I don't think Earl's going to accept that.
Sure, I understand what you're saying.
No, but I'm not saying
that justification's
reason,
a bit dicey.
It's not a justification.
Yeah.
I'm just saying.
Look, all my nice theological language doesn't solve ultimately the problems. Human beings have been dealing with this for as long as they've had the beliefs that justify the issue. Okay, so now we have to study the book of Job. Now that we have the questions and the issues, we have to look for some answers. I'm going to put aside my notes of the introduction, and we're going to read the first chapter of the book through. We'll do it section by section. We're going to read now the first five verses. We already read one of the first five verses, just for a taste, and now we're going to go back and read the whole verses. There was a man in the land of Uz named Job. That man was blameless and upright. He feared God and shunned evil. 7 sons and 3 daughters were born to him. His possessions were 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 500 yoke of oxen, and 500 she-asses in a very large household. That man was wealthier than anyone in the East. So let's go back verse by verse. First of all, I just want everyone to know that Job wasn't called Job by his wife. She called him Eov. It's in Hebrew, it's Eov. And I think it's a good idea to call him by his Hebrew name. So I'll do my best to remember, even when I'm reading the English, to call him Eov.
What's
what does it mean?
Yoav?
Yoav, no, not Yoav, Eov.
Who was Yoav?
Oh, Yoav was the how do they call it in English? I don't know, the general in command of the army of King David.
Yes.
Yoav. So there was a man in the land of Uz, it's Uz in Hebrew, named Eov. That man was blameless and upright. He feared God and shunned evil. Now, there's hardly a nicer thing you can say about a guy in the Bible. What more can you say? Blameless, in Hebrew, that is tam, tamim. It's a word used to refer to the sacrifices when they have to be perfect, without blemish. Jacob was an ish tam, which a perfected person. Don't mistake it for the rabbinic use of the word, like of the 4 sons and the Pesach Haggadah. That tam, there's the simpleton. That's a later development, it looks, in the meaning of the word. In the Bible, it means tamim means to be perfect. Avraham is told by God, Hitalech lefanai veyet tamim. Walk before me and be tamim. It seems to be the highest thing. Avraham is told to be tamim. Job, Eov was tamim. He was tam, excuse me, tam, tamim, so same thing, plural, singular. He was tam, and he was upright, he was yashar. Again, the best thing. He feared God and shunned evil. Now, feared God, moderns might read that pejoratively, as if he's only feared God, he quaked in his boots, he was afraid of punishment, but he really had no sense of love of God. That's not the way the Bible means it. A God-fearing person is a religious person, a person with great reverence and awe of God. Perhaps you should better translate it, he was in awe of God. And he shunned evil. He just didn't do anything wrong. He really did his best to stay away from all the terrible things that sometimes people do. And he had 7 sons and 3 daughters. Notice that those are both prime numbers. Like it's a basic unit. He had 10 children altogether, perfect. And not only that, but the proportion was perfect. In the Bible, you know, 5 girls and 5 boys is not the way it's supposed to be. Boys are more, men are more valued. He had 7 and 3. It's presented as the best in the world. Just, it's supernatural. 7 sons and 3 daughters. And then look at his sheep and his camels. Again, it works out symmetrically. 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels. Again, these 7 and 3. Wow, it's just idyllic. It's so perfect. Well, 2 things. It seems to imply that because he was blameless and upright, therefore he was so prosperous. It doesn't say it explicitly, but it seems to imply that. In other words, hashkacha pratit, right? The righteous get what they deserve. And furthermore, you might ask yourself, just so perfect. Is this perhaps a fairy tale? Did it really happen? That the upright person had 10 children, 7 and 3. He had all this wealth, 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, proportionate to the boys and to the girls. And indeed, there is a approach in the rabbis that say that Eov never lived and never was. He's a mashal. He's a parable. And we'll talk about that later, again and again and again. Should we read it as if the author wants us to take it literally? Or should we read it as if the author wants us to read it as a parable? What difference does it make? Well, just say one example. In a parable, some material is there for background and filler, and that's not the point. The point is someplace else. You have to get to the point and don't get bogged down in the details, where if it's meant to be taken literally, then everything is written because it really happened. So we'll have to ask ourselves that question as we go on. Let's go on to verse 4. It was the custom of his sons to hold feasts, each on a set day in his own home. They would invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. When a round of feast days was over, Job would send word to them to sanctify themselves, and, rising early in the morning, he would make burnt offerings, 1 for each of them. For Job thought, perhaps my children have sinned and blasphemed God in their thoughts. This is what Job always used to do. So he's really righteous, right? He's always bringing sacrifice to God. He's always concerned about sin, so that's wonderful. Except that we'll have to ask ourselves, where did he bring these burnt offerings? Where is this altar?
Jerusalem.
Oh, so did he like live right next door to the Beit HaMikdash and every morning went to the Beit HaMikdash? Doesn't really say that. It doesn't say that he went to the Beit HaMikdash. There's no mention of the temple here. But he's bringing sacrifices.
And does the land of Uz mean anything in particular?
I'm told that this is where the Wizard of Oz got it from. And I'm not kidding.
Oh, no.
And I'm not kidding.
Absolutely.
Right? It's a faraway land that we've never heard of. There is a theory in the Midrash. There, one of, I think it's one of the nephews of Abraham is called Uz. Not a land, but a person. The Midrash tries to make a connection. But on the simple level, we never heard of the place.
Were there other temples at the time this was written, like in Alexandria?
Much so, the question then, when was it written?
Yeah, well, I thought there was some agreement about that. So it's a little iffy.
Yeah, but certainly a number of hundreds of years that are open here. The temple in Alexandria was probably a little bit after.
Oh, okay.
But even if there was some type of temple in Alexandria, normative Jewish law doesn't see that as acceptable. In normative Jewish law, you have to bring sacrifices if you're going to bring them only in the temple.
So Yerb is Jewish.
Very good. So this brings us, now we understand why there are those who would say that Job wasn't Jewish. Because he was Jewish, he wouldn't be bringing sacrifices every other day.
But it could be too that it was written before there was a temple or a Jewish people. And if they're not, he didn't say that.
It couldn't have been that early. It couldn't have been that early. Certainly by the time the book was written, it was a normative practice to bring sacrifices only to the temple. When there was a temple at all. And there's no temple, then there's no allowance to bring sacrifice at all.
When the book is written, it's a separate question from the setting.
Yes. Yes, so you want to claim that its setting goes back to before the Jewish people. Okay, then you have to say that he's not Jewish. Right, he's not Jewish. So there's a basis here to say that he's not Jewish. There's also a basis to say that perhaps the author wasn't Jewish. Perhaps the author didn't even know about the Jewish practice of bringing sacrifice only in the temple.
What's the word for burnt offerings? Is it the same one that you see in Leviticus?
Yeah, it's an olah. I think if you have the Hebrew in front of you, I don't, but I think it's an olah. It's either a zevach or a olah, but they're both words. It's in verse 5.
Which suggests that it's a reference to
it's the classic word for sacrifice.
Yeah, exactly.
Is it olah or zevach? Yeah, olot. Yeah, burnt offerings. It means that it all goes up in smoke, right? Olet.
Okay.
So, like aliyah, to go up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In any case, the story is old enough. Whether the story is true or whether it's allegorical, it's old enough, then likely it was a story with a set story before it was actually written down, so that complicates the matter even a little bit more.
Right, that's certainly possible.
It doesn't say, so.
Yeah. It's kind of a timeless mm-hmm. story, and it could be since beyond a particular religion, right? We throughout the book, we'll really never see anything Jewish, particularly Jewish in the book. Now, just let me add, not only does Eob bring his sacrifices, apparently not to the temple in Jerusalem, but he's bringing sacrifices here to atone for his children. The Torah doesn't have such a thing. Usually. Yes, there are exceptions. There's Yom Kippur. But usually, what's called a korban hatat, a sin offering, or a korban asham, a guilt offering, and there are sometimes you can bring these offerings for sins you're not sure you committed, but they have to be brought by the person who might have committed the sin. But a father bringing it for his children, that usually doesn't fly. So there's another reason to think that the book isn't either the character isn't Jewish or the author isn't Jewish. And of course, what we're noticing here, the editors of the Bible noticed themselves, and they had no qualms about putting it into the Bible. It has an important message, even if we'd say the character is not Jewish or the author is not Jewish.
The names for God are all the names of the Israelite people, right?
Elohim.
Yeah.
Elohim. Yeah.
Is that what L-O-R-D refers to, or isn't that the divine four-letter?
So let's.
Yeah.
Then look over there.
It's Elohim. Oh.
Okay.
Yeah.
But
okay.
Still, I mean, it's an eccentric enough name.
No, but in the Bible, the word Elohim is also used for non-Jewish gods.
Yes.
It's a generic name. It's a generic name for God.
Clearly referring to the one God here.
But it's also used for the one God. I mean, again, it's a generic name, whereas Yud Ke Vav Ke, the four-letter name, is only used for the Jewish God, as
and
it were.
That name is never used.
I'm not sure.
The Lord is the word for Yod Hey Vav Hey, right?
So Adonai is in there as well.
Yeah.
Okay.
It is.
Yeah. It's Adonai and Elohim.
I don't know. I'm leaning toward the Jewish theory.
Okay. Now,
I kind of wanted it, though.
Well, though, too, you know, if the stories, when they get told over time, and sometimes people update bits and pieces, so it's entirely possible that Job might not have used the name of God, but in the retelling, the way that it finally comes to us, it is in there. So again, it's...
Right.
It's hard to prove.
Right, exactly.
Possible.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So now I want to spend just 5 minutes on another question in this group of verses we just saw. What could have been the sin or the sins that Job was afraid that his children committed? That's what you were mm-hmm. thinking to yourself?
That's exactly right.
So what do you think?
What was the...
What sins could it be that Job is thinking his children might have committed? Don't think, you're getting together, or the kids are getting together, they're eating and drinking quite often. What could happen there?
Getting drunk,
right? It could be levity, how do you say in English? Levity? No, levity.
Mm-hmm.
Levity. Levity boisterousness, going beyond boundaries because of drunkenness. Say it again. Yeah, that could certainly happen. So that's a real possibility. But I just want to point out that there's one other possibility, which is hubris. Wealth and affluence and celebration and partying again and again and again. When you have everything, because your father's the wealthiest man in the East, there's a real danger there of haughtiness. Goes to your head. And perhaps he's afraid of that. I just want to point out that this might go back to the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 8. If you have in front of you the Torah there, the Chumash, we could just quickly open to chapter 8 of Deuteronomy, verses 11 to 17. If you don't have it in front of you, then I will read it. I'm quickly going to Deuteronomy 8, verse 11, and it says as follows. Take care, lest you forget the Lord your God and fail to keep His commandments, His rules, and His laws, which I enjoin upon you today. When you have eaten your fill, and have built fine houses to live in, and your herds and flocks have multiplied, and your silver and gold have increased, and everything you own has prospered, beware, lest your heart grow haughty and you forget the Lord your God. I'm skipping three verses. And you say to yourselves, my own power and the might of my own hand have won this wealth for me. Right? Affluence sometimes breeds contempt. It's all mine. I deserve it. There's no other power involved. And you forget God. So that could be what's going on here. And Job is afraid of the extremely negative psychological consequences of the affluence that he's amassed. So he brings sacrifices for his children. Okay. Now we're going to read on to the meat that Celia mentioned earlier. Verse 6 of the book of Job. Chapter 1. One day, the divine beings, B'nai Elohim, presented themselves before the Lord, and the adversary, Satan, came along with them. Now let me stop for a minute. The word Satan, as far as I remember, I might be wrong, appears only one other place in the Bible, in the book of Zechariah. And not too much is said about him. He's just there, and he comes and he goes. This is much more developed, we're about to read here, than any other place in the Bible. Is the word Satan in the Psalms? I don't think it is, but I could be wrong. I remember in Zechariah, it is. Okay. But certainly if it is, it's just a mention. But here's a full developed dialogue between God and Satan. Certainly there's nothing else in the Bible like we have right here. Two, three, four, five, six verses and then more about the Satan. The divine beings, B'nai Elohim, are mentioned indeed in Psalms, mentioned in the beginning of the book of Bereshit. We read about them just last week. They're mentioned, but again, they're never developed into a divine council. They're just mentioned. Actually, in the book of Bereshit, they play a negative role, a pejorative role. But here, they're literally part of God's inner council, His cabinet, as we're about to read. And that, again, in this developed fashion, we don't find any place else, even in the Psalms. We just find mention of B'nai Elohim, but their role is not defined as it is here.
Could it be angels or something of that nature?
But what's an angel?
Good question. Yeah.
Right, we have the concept malach, an angel, in the book of Bereshit. It's another word for a messenger from God, but they walk on this earth, they talk to Abraham, they eat. Right? We do have them going up to heaven, not explicitly in Bereshit, but almost. We have in the book of Judges, the angel going up to heaven. But to have angels talking to God, as we're about to read here, and here we'll see that the Satan is actually presented as one of the members of this council, this angelic council, if you will. He's one of the B'nai Elohim. He's one of the divine beings.
And they don't seem to just be simply doing the will of God. They're kind of like he's having this argument.
Ah, so that we really have to talk about.
This is a little off the subject, but are these the same B'nai Elohim that are mentioned in Genesis 6?
So that's what I said. They mentioned the same word. Same word.
Well, you said that while I was looking at
yeah.
them.
But they're playing a different function. There, B'nai Elohim are some type of rebellious creatures that come down to earth. Mm-hmm. Whereas here, they're members of the divine cabinet. Here we go with the interesting stuff. The Lord said to the adversary, he said to Satan, "Where have you been? Haven't seen you for a while, buddy." The adversary answered the Lord, "I have been roaming all over the earth." The Lord said to the adversary, "Have you noticed my servant Job? There is no one like him on earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and shuns evil." The adversary answered the Lord, "Does Job not have good reason to fear God? Why? It is you who have fenced him round, him and his household and all that he has. You have blessed his efforts so that his possessions spread out in the land. But lay your hand upon all that he has, and he will surely blaspheme you to your face." Bless means curse. The Lord replied to the adversary, "See, all that he has is in your power. Only do not lay a hand on him." The adversary departed from the presence of the Lord. One day, and we read this earlier now, as his sons and daughters were eating and drinking in the house of their eldest brother, a messenger came to Job and said, "The oxen were plowing, and the she-asses were raising alongside them, when Sabaeans attacked them and carried them off, and put the boys to the sword. I alone have escaped to tell you." This one was still speaking. Another came and said, "God's fire fell from heaven, took hold of the sheep and the boys, and burned them up. I alone have escaped to tell you." This one was still speaking. Another came and said, "A Chaldean formation of three columns made a raid on the camels and carried them up and put the boys to the sword. I alone have escaped to tell you." This one was still speaking. Another came and said, "Your sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in the house of their eldest brother, when suddenly a mighty wind came from the wilderness, it struck the four corners of the house, and it collapsed upon the young people, and they died. I alone have escaped to tell you." Then Job arose, tore his robe, cut off his hair, and threw himself on the ground and worshipped. Means he bowed down to God. He said, "Naked came I out of my mother's womb, and naked shall I return there. The Lord has given, the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord." For all that, Job did not sin, nor did he cast reproach on God. Okay, where are we going to start? Well, first of all...
Can I just make one comment before
of
you start?
Of course.
Steve Jobs just died. And he pretty much said that entire statement in his speech at Stanford University. Where he talked about where I came in with nothing and I'm leaving with nothing.
Uh-huh.
I forget exactly how he said it, but
okay.
he may have been inspired by the book of Joel. Who knows?
Okay. I didn't take note of that. I just want to point out before we get into nitty gritty here that this book is not part of the Chumash, not part of the Torah. It's not part of the prophets. It's in the writings, the third part of the Bible, which means we don't necessarily attribute prophecy to its author. But if the author is not a prophet, how does he know what's happening in the divine council? That's another reason to say perhaps it's only a mashal, a parable. If it were meant to be taken literally, well, perhaps it should have been in a different part of the Bible. The prophetic part. Perhaps. Okay. So again, that's a good reason to think that it's only a mashal, it's a parable. Now, so the Satan, of course, suggests that perhaps Job shouldn't get so much credit for God for his righteousness because it's conditional righteousness. He's so great because his circumstances are great. It's easy for him to be religious, to thank God, because look at all you gave him. But if he had nothing, he wouldn't be so thankful. He would actually curse you, God. God, on the other hand, of course, doesn't believe that because God believes in Job. God has faith in Job. It's clear to him that Job's righteousness is not conditional. It's not dependent. It's absolute. He's a wonderful, wonderful person. And therefore, it looks like God is willing to go along with this to prove to the Satan that Job is really worth his weight in gold. That he deserves all the wealth and all the blessings that God gave him. It's not that he's good because of his blessings. It's the opposite. He gets the blessings because he is good. Now, just want to point out that the Satan here, he's a sourpuss and he's a Grinch, but he's not a deceiver. Right? He really does believe that Job doesn't deserve this, and he wants God to do justice. And it's not just, says the Satan, that Job is getting all this goodness. It's not fair. He doesn't deserve it. Let's prove, God, let him prove that he really deserves it by taking away, and let's see how he acts. So, all of this, of course, is very strange, because I didn't know that we believe that there are forces here that can dialogue with God and even kind of call God's bluff and force him into things that he hadn't planned. And that brings us to the two sources that I sent Gary by email. And there it is. So we're going to read now from the Babylon and Talmud, Tractate Baba Batra. This is Rabbi Yochanan. Perhaps I'll say at the outset, Rabbi Yochanan, I don't remember if I mentioned this in a different context to this group, Rabbi Yochanan lived in the 2nd century, we call it the 3rd century in the land of Israel, from about the year 200, 280, lived a long life. He had 10 children, all of whom died in his lifetime. And Rabbi Yochanan also suffered from scurvy for 3.5 years of his life. Terrible, terrible suffering. You can almost say that Rabbi Yochanan experienced the suffering that Job suffered. And that might explain some of the things that we'll see about Rabbi Yochanan's statements about Job today and in the future. Then the Lord said unto Satan, "Hast thou considered my servant Job, for there is none like him in the earth?" And then it quotes actually not just from God saying that in the first chapter, also God says it in the second chapter. Said Rabbi Yochanan, I'm skipping to the end of the third line, "Were it not expressly stated in the scripture, we would not dare to say it. God is made to appear like a man who others try to incite him against his better judgment, and he yields." God doesn't look too good here. And Rabbi Yochanan does not have a solution. He brings forth the issue. He's bothered by the things we just read. It rips him apart and he has no solution. And the next passage from the Talmud Tractate Hagigah, Rabbi Yochanan, when he came to the following verse, wept. "And thou didst incite me against him to destroy him without cause." That's in the second chapter. God complains against the adversary because, as we saw, Job does live up to the test and he doesn't blaspheme. And then God says to Satan, "Why did you make me do it? He suffered for no reason. You see, he's a good guy." So says Rabbi Yochanan the following, "A slave whose master, when they try to incite him against his better judgment, yields. Is there any hope for him?" The slave, that's Job, whose master, that's God, when they try to incite him against his better judgment, other people try and incite God against Job, against God's better judgment, and God yields. Is there any hope for him? Is there any hope for Job? Is there any hope for us as human beings if that's the God we believe in, who's incited by a creature like that, by the Satan? And again, Rabbi Yochanan, it's the same Rabbi Yochanan, he's saying the same thing. He is distraught. He is broken. And he doesn't have any comforting words. Now, you might think it could help to say, it's only a mashal. It's only a parable. And once you say it's only a parable, well, you can say that certain parts are just background to get to the point. And perhaps this whole thing about the Satan and God being incited, that's not really the point. That's just a nice way of saying, of showing of that God somehow brought this terrible suffering upon Job. And indeed, Rabbi Yochanan's best friend and study partner, whose name was Reish Lakish, said it's all a mashal. It's all a parable, but Rabbi Yochanan refused to go in that direction. I'm not sure why Rabbi Yochanan refused, but I have one theory. It's not my theory. I got it from a book I read. Rabbi Yochanan does not want to blunt the real, visceral force of the suffering of Job. It's real. How do we know it's real? Because I, Rabbi Yochanan, have suffered the same things. To say it's all a parable might take away from dealing with the force of the issue. The issue is real. These things do happen. So Rabbi Yochanan is not willing to say it's a mashal. But if he's not willing to say it's a mashal, he's left with this Satan thing. And what is he going to do about it? And it's not clear to Rabbi Yochanan. So I guess the last thing I'm going to do today is I'm going to give you my theory. How we can read it literally, in the sense that let's take it not as a mashal, but take it that we should read it as if it happened, and solve the theological issues here. So, if we read closely, is Rabbi Yochanan right that the adversary baited God? I'm going to claim it's the opposite. God baited the adversary. Because look at it well. Read it well. What happened in verse 7 is, the Lord said to the adversary, so who opened the conversation? God. Who initiated? God. And God said, where have you been? You know, that's saying, like saying, you know, how are you? What's going on in your life? God opens up a conversation with the adversary. Now, God knows the nature of the Satan. He's the Satan. Why would God open up a conversation with him? Unless God has a purpose. And furthermore, the adversary answered the Lord, I've been roaming all over the earth, because that's what he does. The Lord said to the adversary, that's nice, see you tomorrow. No, that's not what he says. He goes on, he says, have you noticed my servant Job? Ah, out of the blue. Out of the blue. God says, have you noticed my servant Job? Now God knows what the Satan's going to say. He's going to say, he's not such hot stuff. Of course. So why does God open the conversation? Because God has a purpose. God is baiting the adversary. God is using the adversary. He wants to go somewhere. He knows where it's going. Because God said, you've seen Job? There's no one like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and shuns evil. Now, even had it not been the adversary, but even if Gary goes up to his friend, you know, I know someone who's a perfect angel. The person's going to say, he's not a perfect angel. I know he did something wrong. Mm-hmm. So, and the adversary, all the more so. He's going to say, he's not such hot stuff. So God has a purpose here. He wants the Satan to go get Job. He's using the Satan.
I'd like to validate what you said by the being, the angel, the immortal, that survives all of the tragedies that befall Job's family and says, I alone have escaped to tell you. In other words, I am the witness that can testify that these tragedies have happened. So who but an immortal would escape all these tragedies and survive to tell, if that isn't a messenger from God?
Okay, that's interesting. I hadn't thought of that.
Well,
okay.
Who is that character that says, I alone have escaped to tell you?
It's
who
not
is
the
that
same
person?
Character.
It's not necessarily the same Satan.
No, I'm not saying it's a Satan. I'm saying it's a witness.
Okay. It's not necessarily the same witness.
Really?
Yeah, it's a different witness.
One person was spared each of those incidents.
Yeah. So just let me go on and finish this thought. So, if this is God with a plan, then what's God's plan? Well, it's clear. Just like God tried Avraham, because Avraham was righteous, God wanted to steal him further and bring him to the highest possible level. So because Job is the great, righteous, upright, blameless person he is, therefore God wants to bring upon him suffering. Wants to try him and steal him and build him up and bring him to greater and greater nuanced maturity and sensitivity. And this is a story how God uses the forces of his divine counsel, as it were, to bring to fruition his plan to challenge Job, to test Job, to try Job. And I think to a large degree that really does answer the theological issues that Rabbi Yochanan is dealing with. God is using Satan for his own purposes, just like God tried Avraham. And this is indeed proactive divine providence. It's not reactive, it's proactive. God has a plan. So, and the plan is going to show Job in his true colors. If he hadn't been so righteous, God wouldn't have brought the suffering upon him.
I'm still wrestling with the... Okay, why was Satan so stupid? I mean, I just put it like that. Because knowing that this is God and any other characteristics we want to attribute to him, if God's going to do this, I would think that he would have to know that that was a setup.
That he would have to know, say it again?
That it was a setup.
That God would know?
No, that Satan would know.
But Satan is just fulfilling his role as Satan. Satan is, let's say, the aspect of God that carries out things that appear to be bad to human beings. Okay. It's just a description of how God manipulates his powers, let's say. That's my reading. That's my suggestion. That's a good place to stop.
Oh, man.
Okay. Yeah. It's a good place to stop, and it's a good time to stop.
Yeah. Oh,
so read ahead, please.